to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today now lives in Chico, but he grew up in a small town in the Midwest in the 1940s and 50s. After he graduated high school, Dennis Wilson joined the Navy, married his high school sweetheart, and completed college in California. He was a teacher, counselor, and school principal for 30 years. Throughout his life, he enjoyed telling stories of life as a kid in the 1950s small town of Quezon, Minnesota, and he has written a memoir, We Had No Fences. Dennis Wilson, welcome.
Thank you.
Am I pronouncing the name of that town right?
You're close. It's pronounced Casson.
Casson. Casson, Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, you could have just kept telling these stories all through your life. You were telling these stories. So why did you decide to write them down?
Well, I knew my granddaughters would forget them as soon as I told them. So I figured I better write them down. And I remember, too, that when I was younger, I didn't really have any curiosity about my mother, my father's past, their history. So, of course, when I grew up and grew older and became interested, they were deceased, and I would never have that information. So that was the motivation behind putting the stories down.
And you do say that another reason is that people couldn't believe some of your stories. So if you put it in print, people are more likely to believe it if it's in print.
People believe anything in print, yes.
Well, I thought it was interesting, too, that you start in early in your book. You have a quote by Mark Twain. When I was younger, I could remember anything, whether it happened or not.
I find that very valuable advice.
Well, because some of the things you write about just sound so hard to believe. Did you embellish any of these stories, or is this just the facts?
No, they're as close as I can recall them. You know, I don't recall the exact words that were exchanged,
of course, yeah.
But the stories are the same. I didn't change the stories. Some of the wording, some of the vocabulary exchanges, some of the comments were made back and forth are on target, but you have to make up some of the dialogue, of course.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But you know what? I was impressed with your recall of these things that happened so long ago, because there are things that were similar that happened to me growing up in a small town, and I had totally forgotten about it. And when I would read your account of what you were doing as a kid, I thought, oh, my goodness, I remember doing that. But your recall is so accurate. I was really impressed with that.
It really is not very magical. I've been telling these stories on and off for years, and people would even say, why don't you write that down? Why don't you write a memoir? And, of course, I'd laugh, and so I started writing the stories just one at a time, and then they kind of morphed into a book. I don't know what happened.
So this, you didn't just sit down all at once and write all these stories at once then?
No, it took probably 4 years or so to put it together.
Describe for the listeners what's on the cover of your book, the photograph.
It's the one historical figure in the entire town of Cass, and it's the water tower. It's about 100 feet or so in the air, and it was built out of limestone. Very, very attractive. And then it's capped with a silver tower with a big printing of Casson on it. And you could see it all over town. In fact, if you could get up there, which you could not, but if you could, you would have been able to see the entire village from one end to the other.
Did you ever try to climb it?
Not me.
Because you tried a lot of things when you were a kid.
That was one we didn't do.
Well, you start out saying that you, of course, grew up in this town, and when you were a kid, you took piano lessons, and one of the things that I was saying, that, you know, things I've forgotten about in my own when I was a kid, and I thought, oh my goodness, he studied piano lessons from the same book that I took piano lessons from, or that I studied.
Hmm.
And do you remember now, because it's been a while since you wrote this?
Teaching Little Fingers to Play.
Teaching Little Fingers to Play. And I not only remember that, you said my little fingers wanted to play all right, but not the piano. And
I was pretty young, yeah.
And I remember this very, do you remember the tune you mentioned in your book?
The Volga Boatman.
I remember playing
do
that
really?
Tune. I do. I really do. You said, I believe it was song number 4 in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a teacher named Maudie, mm-hmm. and she tried her best to teach me, but I knew she could go no further after I'd butchered the song for the 10th or maybe the 100th time. And so she ran out of patience.
She did. I say that she slammed the lid down on my fingers, which was a slight exaggeration. Uh-huh. I did move my fingers before it made it all the way down.
Because I don't think she would have been cruel. She would have done something like that. But you said you said you haven't cared for Russian music since.
I have not.
My guest is Dennis Wilson, and he's written a memoir of growing up in the Midwest in a small town in Minnesota, and he calls it We Had No Fences. And this kind of comes up when you talk about your dog, or all the dogs in town.
Yes, although I think it's more of a kind of a reference to that particular time.
Oh, yeah.
There were no fences. We had no real limitations. We had very little parental supervision.
It's more than just literal fences, in
yes.
other words.
Yes, we were free to roam the town, which we did, day and night. And if it was dark out, it didn't matter because we knew our way through all the backyards. We knew where the gardens were. We knew where to duck under the clotheslines. It was our orchard, so to speak. And there were no fences at all. Of course, the reason for that was this is snow country. You couldn't put up a decent fence and have it stay. But that was our freedom. And that's what led to a lot of the stories, of course, that are mentioned in here.
In fact, now that you're just saying this, I remember one time at a spend the night party, we used to have parties with my girlfriends. And we just decided we'd walk down this residential street in our pajamas in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. We thought nothing of it. Felt totally safe. It wouldn't have occurred to us not to feel safe.
We didn't know anything else. We didn't know there was, we never imagined someone would want to steal a child or abduct a child. It just didn't enter our world. The most dangerous thing probably was some stray dog chasing you. And even that didn't happen very often.
Well, there was a time, too, when you had to go pump water from Van Allen's well.
Yes.
Why did you have to do that?
We lived, my brother and I had to live with my grandmother for some period of time. I'm not really sure how long it was, perhaps 2 years. She lived in a very, very tiny house, about the size of a modern-day garage, two-car garage. And the house didn't have running water. So we had to go to the neighbor's pump because my grandmother's well was not good. And so it was a matter of politeness that you knock on their door and ask if it was all right if you used their pump. And of course they would say, yes, it's all right, go right ahead. You might do that a couple times a day, but you still went through the same format and asked permission. It was just courtesy at that time.
Well, we might then go back to why you had to live with your grandmother for a while. Because she was not set up. Her house was very tiny. She was not set up for guests.
No, not even little ones.
And you were small when you were lugging this bucket of water. I thought, gosh.
Yes, it probably weighed almost as much as I did. Mm-hmm. I didn't fill it to the top. Or if I did, it wouldn't be filled to the top by the time I got it in the house.
Mm-hmm.
My leg would be soaked. But both my parents had tuberculosis, not uncommon in those days. And so we were planted with Grandma Olson. And she took good care of us. She was kind of a strict lady, but she had to be to keep us two under control. At the time, I was probably 4 and a half or so. My brother was 2.
That's what I mean. You're lugging a bucket of water when you're just not even 5 years old.
Yeah, well, we pitched in, or we tried to. And, of course, Grandma had us doing as much as possible to keep us busy, keep us occupied and out of mischief. And Highway 14 ran not too far from the front door, and the railway tracks were not too far from the back door. So she had to be pretty careful about where we were and kept a pretty close eye on us.
So at this point in your young lives, your parents both had to go away to mm-hmm. a sanitarium because of tuberculosis. Mm-hmm. And I remember that time, too. It's a vague memory. Because I didn't know many people. No, nobody in my family had to do that. But I do remember people in our town that had
it was sort of a predecessor of polio. Mm-hmm. You may recall the huge scare that existed when polio was going around.
Yeah.
And the restrictions, and you'd hear stories of friends who may have polio. And, of course, you just close the door a little tighter and stay inside.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Dennis Wilson, and he has written a memoir, We Had No Fences. And there was a time when you had to stay with your grandmother, and she had no running water. That means no indoor plumbing. That means the bathroom was outside.
Way outside, especially in the wintertime. It was behind the shed, and the shed carried or held wood for the cook stove, which she had to use. And she had a little barrel of oil out there for the stove in the what we call the living room or the main room. But to get to the outhouse, you had to walk past the shed. And I would imagine by, I would say probably 50 yards to get all the way out. So in the wintertime, my brother and I would cheat a little bit.
It's a cold walk.
Well, especially if you wait too long. And then it was a run, not a walk, of course. But my brother and I found that in the wintertime, in the evenings, if we had to use the outhouse, we would just find a snowbank, and then all you had to do is cover it with fresh snow when you were finished. Just brush a little over the top.
And you do have a photograph of your grandmother Olson in here. You do have a few photographs, not a lot, but you do have one of her. And I looked to see what shoes she was wearing since you described the shoes.
Oh, yes.
What was your grandmother? You say she had to be pretty strict with you too at that age.
Yeah, she was. She was. But she was a very, very loving person. I think people need to remember that at that time, in the late 40s and 50s, parents and grandparents did not show affection. I mean, not physically. They didn't put their arm around you. They didn't say, I love you. It just wasn't done, not just in my family, but in the families of my friends and everyone I knew. It was just considered poor manners, I suppose.
But, and since that was normal, you didn't take that to mean you weren't loved.
No, not at all. In fact, Grandma Olson, while we were staying with her, would oftentimes go out of her way to make sure that we stayed healthy. And that sometimes meant taking hell of her malt and cod liver oil. But I also recall one time when we caught a small minnow. Wasn't a minnow, maybe it was a little sunfish in a creek not far from the house. And brought it back, and she cleaned it, and she put in a little frying pan with butter and prepared it and put my brother and myself at a little table in her tiny kitchen. And we ate that fish. There wasn't enough for her, but she cooked it for us. And to me, that was love.
Well, also in this town, you talk about the doctors there in the town. Mm-hmm. And one of them in particular, and Dennis, it was just so touching when you contacted one of these doctors many years later. And I was wondering if you could read, first tell us who this doctor is.
That would be Dr. Affeldt.
Yes. And you have a paragraph here in your book that shows how caring he was and how much respect you had for him. Would you start reading that there at the bottom of the page?
Oh, sure. Many years later, then an adult, I called him long distance from California. He was quite elderly then and retired. I asked if he would visit my mother, who was in Minnesota, to attend her sister's funeral. I explained to him that my father had been killed the day before, Thanksgiving Day.
Now stop there for a second, because that was so shocking. I'm reading along. Your mother has gone back to Minnesota. She's been living in California. She goes back to Minnesota to attend her sister's funeral.
Yes.
And then she loses her husband right at that time.
It was a very bad time.
Thanksgiving Day.
Mm-hmm.
And so what are you going to do? Because you're in California, too. There's your mother in Minnesota. So what? Go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead and finish that.
He was killed the day before, Thanksgiving Day, on a California highway. I explained to him why my mother was there and added that she had been through two recent heart attacks. I didn't have to go any further. He understood what I was thinking, and he volunteered to break the news to her in person. I don't think I've ever had a stronger feeling of respect and admiration for another human being.
My guest is Dennis Wilson, and he was just reading from his memoir, We Had No Fences. And you were saying, too, about this doctor, you remembered him sitting up all night with your little sister by her bedside when she was ill and checking her vital signs from time to time. And then, because at that time you mentioned polio, everybody was afraid of polio. In the morning, he accepted a cup of coffee from our grateful mother and went upon his rounds.
I don't think he even charged for that. I really doubt it. He was a country doctor in the truest sense, the kind that you might read about or see in an old movie but not really believe existed, but he did. And
well, I think anybody would be touched by that paragraph in your book. Mm-hmm. And particularly I was, because my grandfather was a country doctor.
Oh.
And people loved him. Long after he died, they would talk about him and said that he could tell more with a tongue depressor and a stethoscope than doctors can with all their fancy equipment mm-hmm. now. So I found that a very touching paragraph. And for you and your mother to have to go through that and to have this wonderful doctor there that you could call on after all those years.
Yeah, we just had an amazing trust in him and obviously a great respect.
Well, that was jumping ahead a few years. But when your dad, when you were growing up and smoking was something that kids wanted to do because it was cool. And so I'm reading along and your dad says, okay, kids, you and your brother Gary, mm-hmm. It's time for you to have a cigarette.
Start smoking.
Time for you to learn to smoke. And so why did he do that?
Oh, we had been badgering the poor man. And smoking was so common at that time. Men smoked, women smoked, ashtrays were everywhere, cigarette butts too. And so my brother and I just wanted to be part of the adult population. And so we kept saying, Dad, how long before we can smoke? Can we smoke next week? And he would put us down, but he would say, no, you're too young, you can't smoke. And finally one day, after we'd been asking again, he said, fine. He said, I think it's time you learned how to smoke. And so he took us in and sat us down and gave us each a cigarette, and he lit the cigarette for us. It was a little difficult at first until I realized you had to draw on the cigarette and not blow through it. Yeah, it was a little confusing, but I was a little slow. So we puffed on the cigarettes, and my dad sat right across from us, and I got about halfway through, I guess, and I was feeling terrible, just woozy and a little nauseous. And I put my cigarette out in the ashtray my dad was holding out in front of us, and my brother smoked for a little while, and then he put his out.
Your brother, by the way, is 2 years younger.
2 years younger, yeah. We were probably about 4 and 6 by then.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. That young. And you were wanting to smoke when you were 6 years old.
Oh, yes. Everyone did. So he held the ashtray out to my brother, and he put his cigarette out, and Dad said, this is where he played his ace. He said, would you boys like another cigarette? And, of course, I said, oh, no, I don't feel very well. And my brother said, yeah, I'll take another.
Well, your dad was pretty clever.
He was.
You have to give him credit for that.
Yes, he was.
Well, in this small town, there's a character. Now, some of your friends and other people, I don't have a mental image, a picture in my head when I was reading. I had to conjure up one. But there was one character in your town. I had no trouble imagining exactly what this guy looked like.
Oh, I know who you're talking about, I think.
Tell us about George the Cop.
Ah, I knew it. George was unique. He was a very small man, very slight. Probably in his 50s at the time he took the assignment. He was probably the model for Barney Fife, who came along later on television. George the Cop wore a regular uniform. He had a police car that was a late model Chevrolet at that time, a 53. Very little power, but a good heater, which was necessary in the wintertime. But George was balding. He wore glasses. He was very excitable. And when he would get excited, he would tend to tremble and shake, just like Barney Fife. He was also, unfortunately, a little too, how can I put it, eager to back himself up with his handgun.
A lot of times you mentioned he did something with his left hand because he was right hand free to grab that gun if he needed to.
Yes, yes. And on one occasion he did draw the gun, and after ordering an intoxicated man to stop, and the intoxicated man made a comment back to George that was not very respectful and walked away, and George fired a shot into the ground. But it was the concrete of the sidewalk, and the bullet ricocheted and hit the man on the bottom of the foot. He had to go to the hospital, and of course, it made the newspapers.
And not just the newspaper in your hometown, your weekly, but you said it also made the paper in Minneapolis and Rochester.
Yeah, well, that one made Rochester. The one that made the Minneapolis paper was one under a title Coke Bottle Cop, because he was checking doors one night and the local gas station door was not locked. So he walked inside and there was a robber inside who beat him over the head once, conked him on the head with a Coke bottle and ran out the door. Well, George slapped leather, but he'd forgotten his gun and holster in the car because it was pretty heavy and he wasn't a big man. So that story made the Minneapolis paper.
And you can just see Barney Fife doing that, reaching for a gun that's not there.
It wasn't there. He had a bump on the head besides.
Well, there was one thing that I thought was really funny. When you and your friends, as you got older, you were pretty full of mischief. And you were always coming up with things, particularly if you were a little on the bored side. A little bored, you would dream up something, some kind of mischief to get into. And I thought it was the story where you decide you're going to move a friend's car. You knew how to hotwire the car. So you're going to move his car where he and his, when he comes out with his date, he's not going to know where the car is.
Yes, yes. That was cruel. But it was a lot of fun.
But now, how did George get in on the scene then?
Well, George didn't get in on it right away. He was home, probably for dinner.
Because this is evening.
Yes.
This is not
yes,
daytime.
This is after dark. In fact, it's probably around 10 at night, somewhere in there. And we didn't know George was home at that particular moment, but it was an inspired moment. And so we took advantage of it. And we pulled up to a very small restaurant. It was actually a Quonset on the edge of town. And there was one car there belonging to a friend of ours. And we noted that he and his date were inside having a hamburger. And there was his car sitting all by itself, unprotected, unguarded. And there we were, full of inspiration. We had to make our own excitement. So we did. And so that's when we performed our dastardly deed. Would you like me to read that little segment?
Yeah, because you hotwired his car, mm-hmm. and you decided to park it. It wasn't very far away that you parked it.
No. You have to remember, the town was like maybe a square mile.
Because one time you said something was located on the far north of town, and you had to go all the way to the other end of town. It took you as long as 3 minutes.
I must have been speeding.
So, yeah, why don't you read that about what happened to George and when you moved the car?
Yeah. Well, we saw the car, and I'll just start reading
here. Yeah.
Once again, genius came to the fore. Remember that I mentioned George the cop lived behind my parents' house? He parked his patrol car in the crushed rock driveway area at the side of his house, just off the street, and across from the high school. It crossed the path I took when I walked to and from school through our yards. Well, Jerry and I, that was my partner in this crime, quietly pulled Dan's car into that parking lot, snug up to the driver's door of George's squad car. There was barely enough room for a skinny person to squeeze through between the hot car and the cop car. We pulled the hot wire and slipped away. By then, it was getting late, so we headed home. It was time to get out of sight. We heard the rest of the story the following day. Dan and his date emerged from the Wake-Em-Up Inn to discover his late model Chevy was missing. Beside himself in anger, he reportedly used some bad words. No help there for his Eagle Scout aspirations. Dan called the town's telephone operator, i.e. police dispatcher. The operator knew George was home. The operator knew all, and called him directly. A stolen car was reported. George was energized, a felony. He grabbed his cap and his gun belt, forewent kissing his wife goodbye, dashed out the back door, and turned sideways to squeeze between the stolen vehicle and his squad car, and sped to the crime scene. I was peacefully in bed by then. I don't know if George used his flashing lights. He didn't use the siren. I'm sure he wanted to, but the whole town would have been awakened. Upon receiving the report of the stolen Chevy, George notified the Highway Patrol. They, in turn, issued an APB watch for stolen car bulletin. Dan called his mom for a ride. Throughout the night, George searched the dark corners of our community, the alleys, the dead-end streets, the bushes in the park, for signs of the missing vehicle. Upon his weary return home in the morning, he found his parking space limited by the presence of another car. It was a late model Chevy. He had found the stolen vehicle.
My guest is Dennis Wilson, and he was just reading from his book, We Had No Fences. It's a memoir, and you go through your time as a young kid up through high school. And then when you graduated high school, you went in the Navy. I mentioned that earlier. And boy, some of what you did in the Navy didn't involve being on a ship at first. But when you describe the situation on the ship, I thought, oh my goodness, that's not for claustrophobics, nor for people who get seasick easily.
No, especially that.
But some of the things that, one time when you went home for Christmas, that was an exciting time when you were getting home, on your way home, and you were on a train and you ran into some painted ladies. And you said, okay, I'm going to square off women. But then the next thing, you got a nice ride from a bunch of attractive girls.
I'll never forget that. the whole trip home, I won't forget. I was hitchhiking. I was 14 miles from home. I had my uniform on, my little travel bag by my side, and had just gotten to the spot. One car went by, and the next car pulled over and stopped. And I looked inside, and there were seven young ladies in the car. And they asked if I would like a ride, and I said, you don't have room. They said, oh, yes, we do. Just lie down across our laps in the back seat. And so I did. And it was a wonderful ride home.
Well, you know, that's rather mild, but and your book is not X-rated anyway, but no. I did wonder sometimes, you're writing this for your granddaughters, and you don't hold back the fact that if you find a girl attractive, or if you wonder what a nude woman looks like, because there was a time when you were a curiosity, quite curious about, if we could just see a nude woman. You even went to the carnival to see if you could.
We would do anything to see a nude woman.
And then there was a time when you crossed paths with Ike Eisenhower.
Oh, I got to know Ike quite well. I shook his hand and said, hi, Ike, I'm going to vote for you. Of course, I was only 14.
And you couldn't vote, but
no.
You would have if you could right. have voted. Well, when you, while you're in the Navy, your parents moved from Minnesota to Southern California, to mm-hmm. San Diego. So when you got out of the Navy, that's where you went to school, when you went to college.
Correct, yes.
Because you describe when you're graduated from college and your parents can't afford to send you to college, so what are you going to do? You spent 3 years in the Navy. Mm-hmm. When I come out, then they will pay for my college education.
Yeah, I went at a time when I was still 17. They called it a kiddie cruise. So you would be discharged before you turned 21, a few days before, and the GI Bill was still in existence. So when I got out of the Navy, I had the GI Bill, and it made a huge difference going through school.
Well, I think people of a certain age who pick up your book will just be delighted at the things that they recall from their own youth. For example, when you talked about camping out in a canvas tent in the backyard, I remember, because I had an older brother, 7 years older. Mm. And so I wasn't a Boy Scout, of course, but he was. And so I got to enjoy some of those things, like I remember the tent that he had. So when you were in the Navy, I think people would be amazed that the conditions on a ship were less than like a cruise ship. It's been such a pleasure talking to you, Dennis, about your book.
Thank you. Very enjoyable.
Dennis Wilson's book is We Had No Fences. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.